Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Go-To Food Podcast, brought to you by Deli. Deli is a food platform from the team behind Depop that sells the best independent food and drink products that other shops don't really know about. So head to www.deli.market and discover the thousands of creative products dropping daily and use the code GO2DELI with a double L for 25% off everything from us. But more importantly, today we're joined by an absolute hero, one of the most respected chefs in the world who's currently executive chef at the Ritz, overseeing all their restaurants, including winning their first Michelin star back in 2017. The wonderful John Williams MBE, but not just MBE, CMA, which he received from the French government, the first British chef in history to receive such an honour. Now, talk us through what CMA is, and more importantly, what was the party like? Good food?
Yeah, it was at the French embassy. It was a good few years ago, and a lot to do with a man called Michel Bordin, who was a real mentor to me and who helped to start the Royal Academy of Culinary Arts. He always actually pushed me to follow in his style of cooking, and he's a great escoffier man himself.
Oh, really?
Basically, it's like an MBE.
Right, okay.
Of sorts. I got that for actually cooking French food.
Right.
And helping deliver French food in England. And that was part of it, and obviously following in the steps of French chefs, and that was because I've been trained by French chefs. Too many British chefs today forget where they learnt.
Yeah, yeah.
Because anybody that was my age, if you weren't cooking with a French chef, you weren't learning.
No.
Really, yeah.
No cooking. And that's not being disrespectful to any other nation, including our own. But they were the best at that time.
Yeah, so when you got into a formal training environment, it was the kind of French canon that you were being
100%
walked through or taught. Yeah,
100%. Yeah.
And
that's
Bart,
what I loved.
Adam Bart learned that from a man from sort of not France, but from South Shields, but an honorary Frenchman in many ways, in yourself. But people come to the Ritz for classical French cuisine. They come for an experience for theatre. We really want to jump into all that in a second. But how do you sort of balance the ever-changing palettes of like a, you know, modern kind of, you know, high-end fatty demographic with the classical French cuisine you were just talking about there?
Great question.
Yeah.
Because it's something that's very powerful to me. I think I've got to go back right to the very start of when I arrived in the Ritz. We have one of the most beautiful dining rooms in the country, in very much, you know, Marie Antoinette style. And it is a beautiful dining room, and that sets the stage for everything. And I was taken into the restaurant for lunch with the then general manager, and as a couple of dishes came out, there were Staub cooking pots. It's an Alsace cooking pot. They're quite cast iron, dark grey, almost black, with brass finishes, very rustic. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing these and saying, what the hell is that? What's that doing in here?
Yeah.
You know, it was so out of kilter. And on top of that, you know, you start and look around, and there was one or two things which just didn't fit inside the room. And that room is so powerful. Let me say one thing. It sets the stage, and I'll say that again, but it sets the stage for everything, and everything must follow. If you take something away and you add something that's out of kilter, it goes poof, and it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So very early on, I was very quick to actually say, look, it's silver, it's the finest china, it's the finest glassware, mix it together, make sure they hit the table. Now, this was the hard bit. We must modernize. How do we modernize?
Yeah.
And that is actually very, very crucial, because we have a room which is actually staying in style. So the first thing was, you know, yes, change the china and upgrade the china into a different style, but must actually fit.
Mm.
And I've been using a Coquet china for over 16 years, 17 years. I saw it in the south of France, and that was it. But it fitted our food, it fitted everything in the room, and that was the most important first part of the jigsaw. Everything else started to flow. As far as the food is concerned, and that's the very, very important factor. Here I am, a very classic cook in every sense of the word, cooking from recipes from escoffier. Yes, everything has to evolve. If cooking, classic cooking, doesn't evolve, it's dead.
Yeah.
But it can still be classic.
Yeah.
It's how we actually push that forward. If you look at when I started even, you cannot cook the same way or the same foods that we were cooking 50 years ago. We would take 2 liters of cream, reduce it down with a reduction and say, voila, the sauce. Yeah, you take a few spoons of that. That is very, very ultra rich.
Yeah, yeah.
Now what do? We pump it with air and make something so much lighter. But it's all about just taking the food and evolving it.
Would Escoffier have approved of that, like, development?
Escoffier was king at that.
Yeah, right, yeah, okay. So, like,
that's exactly what he was.
It's very much in his tradition anyway.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. He was pushing forward all the time.
Yeah.
And that's what cooking is about. You cannot actually go backwards. Yeah. You have to go forwards. You know, you have to think for the customer of what they can eat. And if something is too rich, you're not going to sell it.
No.
And it's not going to work. If you look at some of the dishes that don't really appear, a civet de lièvre, which is a hare, jugged hare, basically.
Cooked in blood.
You don't see it, do you?
Right? Yeah. Yeah, no.
It's because, it's a very rich dish and you've got to change that.
Yeah.
If you go to the same kind of dish, a la Royale in Paris, they're really, you know, singing with this dish, and every year it comes out and people are saying, no, this is my civet de lièvre a la Royale. But in England, you have to actually look at what people will actually take and what they will actually want. And my job is to freshen the cooking up to make sure that we stay loyal to the recipes. And I do stay loyal to the recipes and literally enlighten them. That's the first thing. Yeah. It's enlightening.
Yeah.
The next thing is a presentation, because the moment you put something on the plate, if it's not looking fresh and vibrant, what do people say? Oh, that's old school. That's horrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you have to be very careful of that. And we live on that. What I do is, and make no bones about it, I have a lot of young lads that have worked with me for a long time, but I use them. And they don't know no other.
Yeah.
And we're going to do this dish. Okay, chef, we've got this, 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 and this. Boom. It's as fresh and as vibrant and today as it could ever be.
Yeah.
You almost see
how they plate.
They will plate the dish, and I'll just say, "Look, that's fantastic." They'll bring a dish to me, and you know it will be, you know, our truffle sauce. Nobody has a better truffle sauce than us because we use a lot of truffles. We use a lot of Madeira, port, and cognac to reduce that down. But you know, that is a sauce that has to be followed through every single day.
Yeah.
And make sure that they're fresh and really vibrant in their flavors. And with that, you see, once they get these kind of things in their head, they follow it with all the sauces, whether it's fish, vegetable, or whether it's meat.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a natural progress. And freshening up the dish of how we cook today is very much on their agenda. They wouldn't know anything else.
They sort of do it naturally.
Almost. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is natural to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not just about John Williams, it's about the team in the Ritz that I have. And the funny thing is, most of them have been with me, the key people have been with me at least 10 years.
Really?
Yeah. You know, the best chefs that I've had are the ones that have stayed.
Yeah, yeah.
Incredible.
And they are pure. They're really pure.
Escoffier also loved theatre.
Bringing
the dining room to life. You guys are sort of the last bastion of the waiters doing incredible tableside service, finishing off dishes. What's the process of them learning, you know, how to finish those off? Is that under your guidance? And also, 100%. Like, can you talk us through a couple of, you know, for listeners, I'll be fascinated to know, like, what do they have to do with a poulet de presse or a canard de presse, you know, something like, can you just take us through a couple of things?
Yeah, well, number one, when I arrived at the Ritz, and they were probably 15 years behind then, God bless them, that, you know, I read on the menu, and it says, in our restaurant, we are service sur plat, which is plated service.
Right, yeah.
And I thought, that's an interesting one. So, of course, you've got these waiters with long gowns and, you know, morning suits, etc., and all the regalia coming, popping a plate down.
Yeah.
Doesn't look good. Now, once again, think of the stage setting,
yeah,
how they're dressed. There you go, madam. It's nothing. It's dead.
Yeah.
And totally flat. And I remember very early on, I said, okay, I said, first menu change. I had a roast duck. I said, you're going to carve that. Well, the first food writer that came in and said, we had a wonderful looking duck come up to the table and the waiter went about butchering it and making a right mess. And I went, whoa. It really threw me, you know, and I mean threw me. And I thought, whoa, we've got a problem here. And then I said, okay, we're going to do some dishes. We need, this is something that needs to happen in this room. I promise you, in the first 4 or 5 years, you know, they would fight, not fight me, but, you know, try to withdraw from doing certain dishes for the simple reason they weren't confident.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that. And I would say, you know, we don't sell many of these. Oh, no, you know, chef. And then one day, one of the guys who was leaving, he said, ah, they don't want to do it. So then I really did realize it wasn't that people didn't talk about doing tableside service. It wasn't happening.
Mm. Yeah, right.
So I then focused really on the younger element of people. And I would do one or two dishes, go upstairs and show them how to do it. I've always loved canard à la presse. It's a dish for me. Escoffier, if you read Escoffier, he says, it is the perfect harmony between kitchen and service.
Right, yeah.
Because if one isn't working at the same time, you know, it's not going to work. Because the duck is very rare. You immediately send it up, the legs are taken off, sent back to the kitchen, and they've got to cook them well done for the second serving. So, of course, you know, that is dynamite for me. I just love that. And we devil the legs. We just literally brush them with a little bit of mustard, a mixture of breadcrumb, shallot, parsley, and then that's sprinkled over the top and put in the oven to get very, very crisp and well done. Because the leg is rubbish if it's anything other than well done. Meanwhile, the waiter is carving the duck, and then somebody else, we have three waiters doing each dish.
Wow.
So one is carving, one is doing the pressing, the carcass goes in. I always put a little bit of port with it because I like the port to help the juices from the carcass to come out. So they twist that, the juice comes out, and then there's a third guy who's actually doing the finishing. Now the sauce in itself, if you taste the sauce when we send it up, it's finished. What they're doing is freshening very lightly. They've got very little ingredient, a little bit of shallot, lots of peppercorn. Peppercorn is the basis. Yeah, it's the basis for a good canard à la presse.
Like a fresh, but like a green, like a fresh peppercorn.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, okay.
You know, a green peppercorn is my favorite.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
But you can use black,
you know,
but my favorite is green. And they just literally work that in the pan, quick flambe, sauce goes in. Meanwhile, the juice or the blood of the duck is coming, and then they just finish with that. Now, the difference with mine, and I obviously feel it is better than some famous places that do a wonderful canard à la presse, is mine is a little bit more modern. It's not thick and set.
Right.
It's like a jus that is finished. And it, the best way I could describe it is if you were to take a couple of nuts of chocolate and just mount it into the sauce, it would look very, very similar.
Okay.
Right, really?
It's almost that slight chocolatey color.
Yeah.
A very dark chocolatey color. But that's the finishing element, and that creates a totally different scenario in the restaurant. Now, the waiters have now got total respect.
Yeah.
They are now building what they've cried about for many years. Mm-hmm. They've realized that by them doing it, people are congratulating them and saying, this is wonderful, this is the best service that you can actually give.
Yeah, yeah. You flipped it on its head. They're proud of it now. It's something
proud of it isn't the word.
Yeah.
My guys are pushing. I tell you, chef, you got some truffles. You know, chef, he didn't have any dishes where we could play about with the truffles with them. chef, we didn't, you know, have you got the poulet de bresse?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, poulet de bresse to me is a wonderful dish. I've eaten it in lots of great 3-star restaurants, and we could probably tell you the ones that they are. And I'm very confident with what we do. We're very, very pure. We get our chicken, we do the demi-doy with the truffle underneath the skin, truss it back up, and of course it's steamed in the bladder. And then the sauce is basically just, I use a little bit of white wine, shallot, lots of mushroom. Mushroom is quite key. Total reduction, and then the chicken stock goes on that. This has got to be done way in advance.
Yeah.
And then total reduction of the stock, and then we just put a little bit of cream. And that's just brought together, kept right until the end. Then I finish with a hint of Van Jeun, and that's my personal touch to that particular dish, because it does go so well with it. Once we've done that, to finish the sauce, I just take a little bit of a whipped cream. And it just finished in there, and it just froths and lightens the sauce up, so it's not too rich. And then that is actually taken. Obviously, they cut open the bladder. The chicken is sitting there so proud. And demi-doy is half mourning.
Yeah.
That's what the truffle aspect is. And they just take the legs off. We have to send the legs back again, because the way that we cook is to concentrate on the breast, get the breast cooked to our liking, and then the legs have to come back. And I've actually changed that not long ago, where we're not poaching the legs. We then send the legs back and brown them.
So they're
a little bit more golden. And then they cut the leg and the thigh and then serve that, and the same sauce is then served on a second serving again.
So you have two sittings, essentially.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Two servings.
Yeah, two servings. Yeah. Sorry, yeah.
You know,
so even when you feel you've nailed something, you're still wanting to kind of see how you can improve it, a little tweak.
You've got to.
Yeah, right, yeah.
You know, cooking never stands still.
Yeah.
The moment that you actually stand still, let me tell you, you're finished.
Yeah.
And that's without doubt. I actually will look for something all the time, whether you go dining and something inspires you. My cooks inspire me more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've got people who are genuinely, they come to me and they say, we've got this dish, chef.
So they're trying stuff as well. They're kind of all the developing time. Stuff. Yeah, right. They're all pushing the you almost a little bit.
They're not pushing me, but I've waited for 40 years. You know, I've been in the industry 50 years. I've waited, let's say, you know, I've been a chef an executive chef for just 35 years.
Yeah.
In that time, it's very, very difficult to get people not just to work for you, to work with you, and to bring that on to you. It's very powerful.
Yeah, yeah.
Because then there's a unity and a desire to create. That's when you know the food is going to be good.
Yeah.
Because they're continuously doing it, and they will challenge every area.
Those chefs, obviously incredible, but are you worried about a younger generation of chefs coming through who haven't been taught the classic sort of mother sauces, techniques? Do you see?
It's an interesting one.
Yeah,
it's an interesting chat. It depends where you are. I think there will always be great cooks, and the one thing, rest assured, the greatest restaurants, the greatest cooks, understand about cooking, and it's classic cooking. You learn from the past, but you move forward in your time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that's crucial. And good food is good food. There's only two types of food in my book.
Yeah.
There's good food and there's bad food. And good food will always rise to the top. And that will be done. When something has been done for a long time, it's because of one thing. It works.
Well, yeah.
And the most modernist chef will always dip back into that. And actually say, oh no, you've got to do that because that's what makes the flavor.
Yeah.
So I don't worry about it. It's how much will actually carry on. And I think it will always be there. But the problem that you have, or the worry that I have, is people, you know, they don't really know how to cook. They don't know how to manage. And already they're saying, oh, well, I'm chef and, you know, somebody puts his name in lights or her name in lights, and they haven't had the training and the development. And how long would you say that it takes to train a cook?
Me, you've been a chef, money.
I was never trained as a chef, though. I don't know. I mean, 10 years?
Yeah. Minimum.
I don't know.
I would say minimum 10 years. And they have to do their craft, but they don't, in so many places, they don't do it now.
No.
Because as soon as you've actually accomplished a section and you might do it well, they might move you to another one. You do that one. Okay, that's good. Before long, he's a chef de party.
Yeah.
And then you say, okay, manage that section. And there's, whether there's four or five people or something, they don't know how to manage.
Clearly, yeah.
You know? So you've got to actually keep them concentrating on cooking and teach them how to manage rather than just say, okay, you're next. But we're pushed into that with the modern day society of, I want it now.
Yeah. What's fascinating, like listening to you talk, people would fetishize the Japanese style of cooking, you know, like where people to become a sushi master, you have to work for 20 years.
Yeah.
And those same people who've watched Hero Dreams of Sushi or one of these documentaries would find almost what you're saying, like a bit, they'd be like, well, yeah, but the food that I know, I don't need to train for 20 years before I can become a chef in it.
But would it be bettered?
But they would fetishize the Japanese thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's almost like they can't, I guess Japanese food has become trendy over the years and that old French style.
Well, a lot of...
They might not see it as so trendy now, but...
There's very few people in this country can actually take Japanese ingredients and dishes and make them with, you know, as an accomplished chef.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
You know, there's only one I can think of, and he's a Geordie. And he's a big lad.
What is it about Geordies and...
The hard lads.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard living.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, it's quite important, actually. Cooking is a hard-working job.
Yeah.
Where you have to really... People don't really understand the amount of work it takes to get from A to B and B to C because of preparation. They see something on TV, you know, there's no work whatsoever. It's bum, 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 bum. You know, there's probably, you know, 15 hours work gone in before to get them with those trays ready.
Yeah.
So that's an important factor of how one operates. You know, for me, it's all about actually working hard. If you can't work hard, you're never going to sustain this job. I think you have to be very well disciplined because otherwise you'll have different standards. So discipline is very, very important. I think the other thing is working under pressure of time. It's very, very difficult.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think there's anything worse than, you know, you've got a full restaurant, you've got other things going on within the kitchens and everything, and you're hitting deadline after deadline after deadline in a compressed time.
Yeah.
And what happens when you miss it? Somebody's complaining. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've really up for it all the time. So you've got to be very careful in how you manage your business. You know, at the end of the day, we have to make money. So you have to have enough business coming in to make sure the business is sustainable.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you have to cost everything and make sure things are fitting in place and you're doing the right things by the customer and by the, you know, the ownerships.
Yeah.
Because that's when it becomes a great business, when you're pleasing the guest. And that is probably one of the most important things. You know, what do I want to do? All I want to do is please the guest, make sure they are happy with what they've received and excited. Not just saying, oh, yes, this is a very nice, but I want to see excitement come from them as well to say, yeah, but that was bloody good.
Yeah, yeah.
That was really good. And that's what gets me. You see, freedom as a chef is when you have your customers really going to town and saying, this is what I've wanted.
Yeah, magical.
Yeah, magical. Lovely. Yeah. You have the other side where you have to manage your business to make sure that it's there the next day and making sure that the profitability is there. The other thing is value for money. Value for money, you know, we can charge thousands as long as the customer that has paid for that says, I paid that, but it was worth it.
Yeah.
You know, when you have those things, you suddenly work with a different freedom.
Yeah, it's interesting. Because some people would level at the Ritz and be, oh, it's all right for you because you can sort of charge what you want because you're clientele.
That's not true.
But it's not true. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We, you know, yes.
Everyone's got to provide value no matter where you sit 100%. On that kind of...
100%. Yeah. Do you know, after lockdown, everybody was saying, oh, we have to change our menus. We have to do this. We have to do that. I said, no. I said, our ingredients are everything what we are to the Ritz. That's the other thing. The ingredient has to fit with that dining room.
Yeah.
You know, I pay a lot of money for one piece of langoustine. One piece. I can pay £9 for one if the size is big.
Yeah.
You give three of them on a plate and people, you know, that's before you've done anything.
Yeah.
And people suddenly say, oh, that's an but I'll also see people that are charging £40 for something that doesn't have the same kind of value in, that might be £6 or £7.
Yeah.
But you know,
you've obviously got the Michelin star restaurant there. You've got a couple of other places, bars, room service, which we're going to touch on as well. But afternoon tea seems to be one of the most competitive sort of medians in high-end London hotels. Some try and change, modernize, do crazy like themed Polar Express things. but honestly, where do you stand on like staying classical? Because I'm guessing when they go to the Ritz, they want the piano in the background, they want lovely champagne, they want a proper afternoon tea service. How important is that to the business as well? And what's your favorite item?
Mega.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of our biggest parts of the business there is in the hotel.
Really? What, in terms of revenue?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
This is so important. And it, you know, all in all, when you take a food and beverage concept, that helps the whole thing about what I'm doing in the restaurant. But the style, you know, you walk into that Palm Court, once again, it's set a certain kind of stage. Number one, sandwiches must be very, very classic. I don't want to see any chicken tandoori sandwich sitting on the Ritz afternoon tea.
No.
You know, nothing that I've got, nothing against that. No. It's just, it doesn't fit. It's the cucumber sandwich.
Yeah.
It's York ham, you know, and mustard.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, some people would say, well, what, smoked salmon? You know, I put a little bit of cream cheese. We put a hint of horseradish and a hint of basically lemon zest pushed through just to heighten it. And then the smoked salmon. The smoked salmon's got to speak.
Yeah.
You know, so those kind of things.
Egg mayonnaise with the shallots looks great.
Always.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't. Always, yeah. You know, and I'm afraid it's one thing that hasn't fundamentally changed. We might have actually put a herb in there different.
Yeah.
But other than that, the sandwiches remain. The pastries... and the scones must remain. Obviously, there we do two types of scones. We've done different kinds of finishes, of different kinds of jams, etc. But fundamentally, it's a cream tea. You know, the scones are very specific. We make 1,000 scones a day.
Wow!
And you've got to be actually on it to actually make sure that that's rotating. And they're done. You know, they start at 4 o'clock in the morning. Getting the scones ready.
Really?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's full on. There's a team down there of 6-7 just for pastries. You know, and you're making 450 pieces of those individual pastries every day. There's three types. So that tells you the number there. And then we have two trolley cakes. I like to have same thing again. I want to have service.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we do two large cakes and everybody can have a slice or two of that, whatever they would like. But that is very classic. And I think afternoon tea, whilst you must keep it very, very classic, it's also, I'm looking to evolve. That's all I'll say.
Yeah, yeah.
I am looking to evolve slightly to bring something else to the table because everybody would love the business we have.
Yeah.
You know, we are doing 400 every day, 7 days a week, afternoon teas.
Wow. Crazy.
Four settings. And I remember people used to laugh at me because when I went to the Ritz at first, there's only two sittings.
Really?
And the general manager and the financial controller said, do you think you would do more? I said, why not? It was, for me, you know, it's something, providing you've got the personnel to do that, it's not a situation. It's an easy service for the cooks.
Yeah.
But it's very monotonous and it's very stringent with how they operate. But it works. And, you know, they're very fortunate to have that business.
Yeah.
But Scott Fear wasn't a fan of afternoon tea. I saw a quote from him saying that it's, you know, why fill yourself up a couple of hours before a wonderful supper?
That's exactly it.
Really?
You know, no, he did. Yeah. He thought it was the wrong time. And if you have a good lunch and you have dinner, afternoon tea, you know, you've got to take something out, haven't you?
Yeah.
You know, well, so I agree.
The Queen famously danced on VE Day at the Ritz 1945. Sort of 40 odd years later, she was celebrating her 60th. You cooked for her. What was on the menu? And did she get engaged in the menu at all, or was it like a surprise?
There was Lady Elizabeth Anson had actually organised that. And she said, look, we're just going to do Dover sole, which we did. It was a champagne sauce. It was quite simple. I think for the Queen or the royal family, I think conservative food is the best way forward. Why try to play with different funny ingredients? I mean, it's common sense to me. Yeah,
just give them delicious.
You know, over the years. Yeah exactly. Yeah. And it's quite conservative. So Dover sole, lamb, and I believe there was also chicken on as an offer that particular menu. So it's fairly straightforward, but it's cooking the best that you physically can.
Yeah.
You know, for me, there is no prouder moment. You can tell me, you know, I've cooked for presidents, you know, all kinds of different people from all over the world, but there's only one that matters to me, and that is our royal family.
Yeah.
There's two particular, the Queen. I think I certainly cooked for the Queen more than 15 times. I did three state banquets in Claridge's.
Wow.
Which were the most frightening of my life. But the man that I love to cook for more than anyone is the King.
Yeah. Well, he gave you the first royal warrant.
Yeah.
Making the Brits the only place they'd go. Does he still come in now? Enjoy a meal?
Yeah, he hasn't been in for a little while. But I went and actually cooked for him.
Well.
You know,
where was that?
That was in Clarence House.
Oh wow,
nice.
He loves mutton.
Really,
he's fanatical over mutton. And I was actually involved with the Royal Academy with mutton. He's you know, greatest honour to do something.
Is
like
he a
that.
Foodie? Does he get involved?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, he's a foodie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really.
I'll tell you one story, and this is honestly, this is the God's honest truth. He got involved in the mutton renaissance, and he asked us, because he was our patron, he said, now you have to work for us. Link up with the farmers. They're having real problems getting rid of mutton. We need to actually bring this to the forefront. I want you to start cooking mutton. So he took us up to North Yorkshire, and there was about eight people asked to make some dishes, and I made three dishes out of mutton. And I was... along with my friend Brian Turner, we were walking, as he was the Prince of Wales then, walking along with all of these dishes on show. I said, you can taste any. And he said to me, which one did you cook, John? So I said, actually, that's one of mine. So he looked at it, and he started actually discussing the texture of the sauce, the colour of the sauce, the aroma, the flavour, and then he started tasting it. He said, whoa, that's good. And I was quite fascinated, you know, and I thought, well, he's going to say that. There was probably about 15 dishes, and I had another dish come up about four rows down, and I said, actually, I've done three. And as we were walking along, he says, you did that one as well, didn't you?
Wow.
I said, how do you know? He says, look at the way the sauce is, the colour of the sauce, the shine, you know, the texture of the sauce. And I'm going, he's really thought about
this
and tasted it. And then just for luck, this is a God's truth, the very last dish was also mine. And he says, by the way, that one is as well, isn't it?
Oh, my God.
And that's the God's honest truth.
That's wonderful.
He's got a palate on him.
A tremendous palate.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah.
You know, I mean...
Can you remember what the dishes were? I mean, it's...
Yeah, there were variants. Basically, they were all mutton.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. The first one was a fricassee.
Okay.
The second one, what I had done was I had tenderized the best end with a little bit of yogurt and everything, and then just roasted it, and then we had some nice jus with it.
Yeah.
And then the last one was a saddle.
Nice.
Which we had actually stuffed and roasted.
Ben, drinks and a bit of food? I think just bring it all out and tell us what you got, because...
Yeah, well, so would you be willing to have a little Bloody Mary with us?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or a tomato juice?
Yeah.
I know you're heading into work.
Yeah.
What would you rather?
I'll have a taste of the Bloody Mary.
Yeah, okay.
If it's a good Bloody Mary, well, I wouldn't
there's
miss
a lot
it.
Of pressure now.
Okay. And then I've made, I think it's in the introduction to your book, I remember reading you talking about when you were a child, something to do with potatoes.
I love potatoes. Love potatoes. Only one special type of potato.
Oh no, which special type?
There's only one.
What is it?
What's the best potato we have here in this country?
I don't know. I've cooked a Lorato potato.
It hasn't got a hope.
So what's the number one potato?
Jersey
roll. No one's
Ben, just get out of it. No, you've shamed yourself in front of John.
And then a little, I think this is you. Your mum used to make plate pies.
That's it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So I made a little corned beef plate pie. Oh, I don't know if
magic.
You would have done corned beef.
But. That's lovely. Well, as you bring that all out, John, obviously you grew up in South Shields.
I'm going to go to my little...
You get down the floor, your floor kitchen, your goblin kitchen. Your father was a fisherman, I believe?
Yeah.
What part did food play in your upbringing? Because obviously your dad was away in the fishing boat. Did he come back with fish?
I'm guessing. Basically, when he got paid, they had what was called a fisherman's fry. There's a lovely story here. And my dad used to come up the road. There used to be seagulls for him. He'd probably have a cigarette in his mouth. And he was definitely drunk.
Yeah.
And he'd have his bass bag. And there'd be all kinds of fish in there. They always give things like a little bit of maybe smoked haddock, piece of cod, plaice or whatever. But the one piece of seafood that he would get, and you'll understand why of the period, would be claws from the prawns, the langoustine. Yeah. And the reason was because, of course, they used to take the tails and send them off to be made into scampi.
Oh, good.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So the claws were left, and he used to actually bring the claws, and he'd say, here, grab that. Real rough Geordie.
Yeah.
He'd say, bite into it. So I bit the shell, snapped it off. He's right, suck it. And I found that was the sweetest prawn meat that you could ever
best,
have.
Yeah.
And to this day, I make my cooks... They have to cook the claws totally separate. Not many people do this because it is very laborious. And just drop them in the corbouillon. As they come out, as soon as they come out, a couple of them will be taking them, clip the claw end off, and then just pull with the tweezers.
Yeah.
And it pulls the beautiful piece of claw meat out.
Ugh.
And that goes on the langoustine à la nage. And probably where I come from that moment was the learning of where... my favourite dish is langoustine à la nage.
Yeah.
And it's about letting the prawns speak and just making this light sauce that will actually enhance it.
We are going to keep on with your childhood. Just quickly, you made me think. I read about Adam Byatt, who's one of your protégés, and he's taken over as the chairman of the RACA. RACA, whatever you want. Yeah.
RACA,
I should say.
Royal Academy of Culinary Arts.
Here we go. Here's one bloody mouth user. I just want to ask, like, he said that when he gets a new chef at Trinity, which I'm guessing you've eaten at.
Yeah.
Have you? Yeah, you enjoyed it? Yeah. Maybe you didn't enjoy it?
Yeah, very much.
I did, yeah. When he gets a new chef in, he gets them to do an omelette and he gets them to do a couple of other things. Do you have a test for a new omelette when they come into the kitchen?
An omelette is actually a very good test.
Yeah.
I would say... I'm going to say...
That's a bit domestic.
75%... of the chefs can't make an omelette. So it is a very,
really?
Very good test, yeah. What I do, in all honesty, I will actually say to the guys, I say, just let them cook something they think is suitable for the Ritz. And you'll be amazed what you get.
can you give us the best and the worst?
It's not the ingredients that would actually... give you the answer there, really, because people have used some very, very expensive ingredients but just made a mess. They've got no palate. If I give you our stocks and sauce and say, okay, just finish it, And to make a mess of it, you have to work very hard to make that mess. And you see that very quick. And it I'm very easy because I want people to come from strength and show me what they can do. It's a tough thing.
Oh, you got the thought there, sir.
It's a very, very tough thing.
I always feel like you have to try that, John.
I will.
You know, for the podcast, it's not to produce a bit of food.
I promise you, I'm going to try it because it's a long time since I've had a plate of pie. This one's from the only person I ever used to speak to about plate pies, and he understood them. Was Brian Turner.
Really?
Really?
Wherever we used to go, you know, he'd often say, "Should we have some fish and chips? See what it's really like."
Did you know each other growing up, or is just from within the industry?
I've known Brian 35, 40 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Amazing.
That's a great attempt.
From a southern boy from Surrey.
What's wrong with it? Or what's right with it?
The mince, just mince and onions.
Oh, really? None of the other gubbins?
Peas is fine. Not all of that's fine. But it just having a little touch of gravy that's thick enough just to bring it all together.
I was struggling with the gravy, John, I'll be honest with you.
So was it your mum, though, who was your biggest sort of foodie impact? Because obviously then you go off to college and then you come up to London. But yeah, was she the one who made you fall in love with it?
The one thing that I would say, I don't want people to think that she was cooking all kinds of gourmet food. This is the kind of food my mum would make. But when she made plate pies, she'd make something very similar to this, mincemeat. She'd have ham and egg. She would have, she'd always make a couple of sweet ones at the same time. And of course, I could eat a whole one when I was a lad. I was very sportive. And I just used to eat like, I wouldn't go to school dinners. They were horrible. And I was the only one out of the family. She used to have to actually come and cook me something. And all the rest went to school dinners, And there was six kids.
So you left in the middle of the day to go home?
Yeah.
For lunch?
Yeah, I wouldn't. The smell of the food, it used to drive me.
It wasn't
semolina, seagull.
Yeah.
It was horrid. Ugh. And, you know, fish day was the worst. And cheese, for some reason, some of the cheese dishes they did.
Not good.
Disgusting.
Where were you in the family? Are you the eldest, youngest?
Second eldest.
Okay, right.
And I was football mad. You know, very, very sportive when I was at school.
Yeah.
There wasn't a sport that I didn't represent the school in.
Really?
Every single sport.
Yeah.
I was there. And I used to run home. It used to take me 10 minutes, but when I say run, it was a sprint from school. Get in. She used to have the dinner ready.
Wolf it down.
Off I went. And anyway, on a Sunday morning, I used to play football, obviously like any other young lads. And my mother, one particular day, and it's very, very specific because there's another thing that's going to pop up here, shouted over the fence, "John, get in here." She was livid. She said, "I need a hand." So she says, "Right, come on, let's get this dinner done." And Jersey Royals. And she says, "Yeah, scrape them like that. This is how you scrape them." So I scraped all the jerseys, put them in a big pot, and she put them on. And she says, "Make the mint sauce." She had this cup, chipped cup, and she chopped the mint. She says, "Chop the mint." I chopped the mint. Little bit of sugar, little bit of water. I said, "Bloody," a little bit of vinegar. Pop it in the oven, just like that.
In the cup, right?
It's so specific.
Yeah.
You know, nobody else has ever heard of that.
No, is that a thing? Like,
no.
That was just her way of...
That was just her.
Right, okay, yeah.
But the beauty of that day was, it must have been getting on by 12 o'clock then, and the potatoes come off at 12:30, and she went, "Here." So there's four Jersey Royals, and they were quite big Jersey Royals. And she says, "Here, watch this." And she just put some butter on the top of the boiling hot jerseys. She says, "That's your treat for helping us." And honestly, I went like this.
Done.
Jesus. It was magnificent.
You must have eaten her. I mean, you've eaten potatoes with her before that. It was something about the like the moment and preparing them and whatever it was.
I remember that.
And then were you away? Was food kind of in you by that stage?
Yeah. And she used to make me help her.
Right.
I was a helper.
Yeah.
I used to go shopping with her. She used to make me carry her bags.
Yeah.
Everything. I was, you know, she knew I was that. I don't know. She just made me.
Mm.
And I would say, okay, man.
Yeah.
John, can I ask? Because obviously you said your dad enjoyed a drink after, you know, work or during work, whatever. But obviously cooking back then wasn't as a macho industry as it was maybe 80s, 90s when...
That's like, an interesting one as well.
Yeah, huge male chefs and stuff. So was your dad a bit, you know, like in Billy Elliot when he starts doing ballet? Was it almost like that? Did you have to try and prove to your dad that it was...
It's an interesting one. At school, there was a thing, it was called a link course. And we... What happened was, I said, I want to be a chef. And the careers officer said, as it happens, there is a college link course where there is a professional chef going to teach chefs.
Mm.
You go one day per week. So for the last 2 years at school, I was actually going one day per week to the college to learn proper cooking.
Right.
And even he took a shine to me and he says, you really like this, don't you? I says, this is where it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
I was always hungry, a hungry lad and wanting to eat. And even then, I knew what I wanted to do. The funny thing was, there were five lads from the year all followed me to do that.
Wow.
And I'll always remember, going back to your real question, my dad came back, he had a good drink, and he was with his skipper. And there was somebody else that was there with him, you know. They were all trawlermen and that. And they were having a drink. I mean, well and truly oiled. And I came in from school and I had some curry. It was the first curry that I made at the school. And he says, oh, what's that? And he had a taste. He says, bloody hell, you can cook and all, can't you?
Right.
So I never had any problem with that.
And there was no inclination from you or pressure from him to go out on the boats as well. That was never on the table.
No, right. No. There's never anything like that. That's another hard life, you know?
Yeah, really hard life.
You moved to London when you were 17.
I wasn't even 17.
You weren't even 17.
16 and a half.
16 and a half. Oh. I mean, especially back in those days, you didn't have internet, phone, connection, anything. Like, it was quite a big move. There was no connection to your mum, who you loved so dearly. Were you homesick when you moved?
I started in the Royal Garden. I loved the job, but I was homesick. I was, terrible. And I mean homesick.
Mm.
And I think I did well to last 1 year.
Yeah.
And I said to my boss, who was Remy Fougier, I said, I'm sorry, I've got to actually go back. I've had enough. Got a job in a place in the northeast. Off I went, and they give me £5 rise because I had London experience. I'd only been there a year. I arrived there. Basically, it was 40 minutes to the job in Newcastle, and I was doing split shifts. So, you know, I was back and forth, and there was 2 hours or so in between. It was a waste of time going home. But anyway, I arrived at this particular establishment. First day, there's a guy there who was a waste of space. And they said, he's going to look after you. So anyway, they've got these potatoes that have, do you know what a potato rumbler is?
Yeah.
There's some new potatoes that have been put through the rumbler and there's eyes in them all over. They were horrid. Big pot. And he says, give us a hand, puts them up on the stove. And 5 minutes later, I'm going to say it's 12 o'clock. The restaurant opened at 12:30 or whatever. At 12 o'clock it opened, sorry. And the potatoes haven't come to the boil. And I hear, Samash, two pomme nouvelle. I'm going, oh, Christ. So anyway, he says, can you just get them out? I says, are you having a laugh? And then he says, oh, can we just put them on the... There was two bricks they had on the back of the stove. Can we just put them up on there? I said, hey, this, you can imagine, this is the first 2 hours or something that I've been there. I said, hey, they're bloody raw, man. You can't use them. He says, yeah, but they'll be cooked at 2 o'clock, though, won't they? And I went, and I can still remember the smell, which I didn't like. The chefs all had cloth hats then. We're talking 1976 or so. And all had the long hair was, had the hats on, but where the fingerprints, you know what I mean? And I used to, this is doing my bonds.
Yeah, so how long did you sort of?
3 shifts. And they says, oh, we like you. I said, no.
I'm so sure about you, my friend.
I went home and I said to my mum, I said, Mum, I've wrapped in. She said, what? I said, yeah, and I'm going back to London. She said, you're joking. I said, I've learned a real lesson here.
Yeah.
That moment, I picked the phone up, got on to Mr. Fougere, Remy Fougere. I said, Chef, I've made the biggest mistake of my life. He says, see you Monday.
Well.
I was there. It was a week's holiday. Yeah.
But then you went back to London. You obviously became one of the youngest ever executive sous chefs at Claridge's, and then went back and ran Claridge's. Had a most incredible career. I do want to ask you, now when you're at the Ritz, when you get like a weird room service call, like, can you remember one weird food request?
The most weird was an ostrich steak. And that's a God's honest truth. That is probably the weirdest thing. And it must have been 25, 30 years ago, where it wasn't so common. And we managed to get it.
Oh, you did get an ostrich steak?
Oh, yeah, we did get it.
Wow.
You know.
Well done.
We know you're going back for lunch service at the Ritz, so I think we have to bring you back for part two for your sort of years pre-Ritz. It's been the most fascinating hour to sit down and talk with you. A couple more questions, though. We do ask everyone who comes on, what's been the biggest nightmare day, like that one day in their career?
It was a function, and it was in Claridge's, and I hadn't long been chef, and there, you know, you'd be looking after 2 or 3 banquets, restaurant, and I used to run up to the restaurant as soon as the function had finished or whatever. But this particular day, there was a shout, a call, you know, oh, you know, the steaks are not quite there, they're not this, and oh, bloody hell. So I've gone across, and the place was a shambles. It wasn't going according to plan. There's a piece of fish. The fish dish was overcooked or something. I said, oh, shit. And I went home. I was almost crying, I think. And I remember driving home, and I said to my wife, I says, terrible night. I says, honestly, you know, the way those guys have worked today and the way they've done this and done that, I'm almost had enough, like, you know. And this is the God's honest truth. And my wife says, ah, you're just being hard on yourself. You're being hard on yourself. I said, yeah. I said, I'll probably get a bloody right seeing to it tomorrow off the manager and that. So anyway, I'll never forget it. 10 o'clock, there was some kind of meeting, and somebody came back and says, Chef, the person that was organising the dinner last night wanted to see you, but you had gone home. Somebody says you were upset. I said, you know, I was just about to go in, and just, oh, well, they just want you to know it was one of the best dinners they've had in their lives.
Oh, my goodness.
Really? Really?
Trust me, it wasn't.
It wasn't. Yeah. No, it's not just you being a perfectionist. It wasn't the best dinner. Yeah.
You said earlier you use more truffles than anyone in the country. I know you love them. If you were given one type of truffle, what would it be, and what would you make?
Tuba Milano Sporum.
And what would you make with it?
Probably now it would be a choice of two things. It might be a truffle menu, actually. We have a custard, a savoury custard, which we just put truffle and truffle sauce on top, and served with a gougère on the side. That would definitely be in there. Probably poulet de bresse en vezi with the truffle underneath the skin. And might even make for my dear friend, if we were going to go for the 3-course meal, I would finish that one off with a truffle creme brulee in honour of Michel Bourdin. It was brilliant.
Really? Oh.
It's not something I do at the moment, but he used to make that, and it was special.
A sweet creme brulee.
Yeah, creme brulee.
Truffle just all over the top. Yeah.
There's a few other things in it, you know, a little marinade. He was the one that taught me about marinating the truffles and then making a cuisson of truffle and then actually utilising them in different ways.
Amazing.
Well, that's quite a bougie go-to thing for that one. Ben, we should say, have you bought a deli bag for John?
I have bought a bag.
So we're going to finish off the way we always do, which is a game of Deli Steady Cook. So we're just going to show you a couple of things in here, and you say what dish you'd make.
These are probably not things that are in your store cupboard. Some northern pasta.
Northern pasta. Well, I'd have to make a northern pasta dish, wouldn't I?
You will.
And that would only be with cheese and tomato. Right, yeah. Got, maybe a bit of ham.
You've got a couple of tins, one of sardines and one of some very, very fine.
Oh, tomatoes. Well, do you know these tins?
They're beautiful.
In very old classical hotels,
yeah,
they used to use the tin sardine on the hors d'oeuvre tray, but they had silver dishes that they fitted in perfectly and
really?
Rolled them back. And a sardine, my dad wouldn't muck about with it any other way. He might have a couple of sliced tomato or a bit of boiled egg on the side, but yeah. He just eats them in
straight
one
in.
Go.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I wouldn't muck about with them.
No, okay. Well, there you go. You can leave those. This is the greatest harissa I've ever tried. Lemuri harissa.
Harissa, well, that would only be for barbecue for me.
Okay, really?
And I
onto meats, onto...
Yeah.
It's going to be hard to barbecue the pasta.
Oh, is it all going together?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't have to.
Oh, my goodness. I thought though, each one was individual.
And then you've got a beautiful little Bloody Mary to take.
Bloody Mary,
it's
yeah.
nicer than the one I've made for you, I can guarantee you that.
Okay. Oh, no. We've got the Bloody... No, it's so simple. Now you've made the dish, haven't you, bringing all that out? You just mix these all together. Mm. A bit of your harissa, seasoned up with the harissa. Cook it down with your Bloody Mary.
Bloody Mary sauce.
Mix it with your pasta. Roll it around. Make sure you cook the things together as well.
Yeah. So you got a sort of a Bloody Mary, harissa, sardine.
100%.
Pasta. That sounds incredible.
Well, I would look for a little bit of coriander and
you
a little
can bring
bit
other
more.
Things. Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, that's for you to take away. You can give it to one of your chefs.
I will do.
Take it home, whatever you like.
Very kind.
John, you've been absolutely fantastic. We need to get you in for part two to really jump into all those other years. You've been the most wonderful guest. We are going to finish off. I know you've just given us the most bougie three-course truffle dish, but what would be your last three courses? And you know, well, we call it the go-to three courses just so we don't get sued.
Three courses, I would definitely start with langoustine, because langoustine is my favorite seafood, you know, and it would be langoustine à la nage. It's a very classic French dish, but we just modernize it ourselves. Very delicate, the langoustine are delicately cooked and it lets the langoustine sing. Main course, it could be it would very much determine on the time of year.
Say now, sort of, where are we? Summer.
Summer.
Or what's your favourite time of year to eat?
Yeah.
Probably autumn.
Okay.
So let's go autumn.
I tell you what, just as we're talking now, we're very close to grouse, aren't we?
Yeah, right. So, yeah.
It would definitely be grouse or woodcock. I mean, woodcock would be a la fine champagne, which is a very classic thing. It's roasted whole, entier, and then you take the innards out once it's just been cooked. They're only cooked for about 10 minutes. And then pass through a sieve, mixed with foie gras. And then, obviously, the sauce is made with a very fine Armagnac. Reduced down truffle, I'm afraid, because I like a little bit of truffle, just to give it a little bit of perfume. Break the carcass down. And then basically finish the sauce with a touch of the innards, but also to make a toast with the parfait of the product on top, which you once you've sieved the innards, you mix it with the foie gras, becomes like a pâté.
Jeez.
And that's just served warm. And the sauce has got to be quite aromatic, but that would certainly be one. Wow. Other than that, I would actually say to you, grouse, but quite simply cooked, maybe with a few blackberries, a little bit of walnut type of thing, and just a very light jus, and never muck about by actually trying to make flavours on grouse. Let the grouse sing. It's a very particular aroma. And cooked medium, never rare.
Never.
I get very upset with people that don't understand that. The taste changes.
Yeah.
And it's much better when it's medium. Pink, English pink as well. It's like lamb, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got to cook these things bloody right. And for me, if you cook them under, it's not quite there.
No.
And then dessert.
If you are really pushing me, I love meringue. I love a vanilla chantilly. So with some beautiful fruit, that would be very simple to me. Other than that, it could be a souffle. But if it was a souffle, it would be souffle Grand Marnier everywhere, because it's the best souffle in the world, other than our chocolate souffle, which is probably the best chocolate souffle there is in the country.
Oh.
Grand Marnier is the one thing that is flavoursome in a souffle, and it works so well. And you've got to remember, it was Ritz that gave the name Grand Marnier. Really? He says, you can't just call it Meunier. It's so good, you have to be Grand Meunier.
And they went with
and that's a true story.
That's great.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, you're too good to be a chef. You're the Grand Chef. John Williams, thank you so much for coming in and sharing us your go-tos and also just your wonderful life story. It's been really, really fascinating to hear. Thank you so much. Guys, we'll be back again next week. That was the wonderful John Williams, MBE. And until then, just leave us a wonderful rating, some comments. Check out Deli, use that code, and we'll see you all again soon.
Lovely.